I was in college, I read a biography, a short biography, of the man John Wesley. Have you heard of John Wesley? John Wesley is the man whose teachings gave rise to the United Methodist denomination, or the Methodist and Wesleyan families of churches. That's the denomination that I grew up in. And there are several commendable things about John Wesley. One is that he was a tireless worker. He was a tireless worker. It's said that he rode 250,000 miles on horseback during his ministry. His ministry was working among churches in the Church of England, the Anglican Church, in the late 1700s, and he would ride really a circuit between three places, and he would preach. He was preaching multiple times a week and also organizing people into these groups that were called holy clubs at the time, where they really focused on spiritual disciplines, on memorizing scripture, on reading the Bible, on praying together. And so John Wesley was a man who, for much of his life, he was really focused on working and expending himself for the Lord. And that's a good model. John Wesley said this. He said, "Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you ever can." He basically said, do as much good in whatever ways you can. And then that quote, of course, is kind of memorable or catchy because of the way he's formulated that there. And John's brother, who you may know or have heard of, is Charles Wesley. He wrote hymns like "And Can It Be," "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." It's probably another several we could name. Anybody think of any others? I'm drawing a blank. But some of the most beloved.
There's a sad one.
Maybe "O Sacred Head Now Wounded," I think, is one of his. But yeah, just a lot of beloved hymns in English hymnody are from Charles Wesley. So I'll talk about them maybe a little bit later on, but the text that we're going to look at tonight, I think that they are in some ways a helpful example for us, but not the best example. Matthew chapter 20, we're going to look at verses 17 through 28. 17 through 28. This is probably divided into two sections in your Bible. I'll start reading in verse 17. "And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside. And on the way, he said to them, 'See, we are going up to Jerusalem. And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And he will be raised on the third day.' Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, 'What do you want?' She said to him, 'Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom.' Jesus answered, 'You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?' They said to him, 'We are able.' He said to them, 'You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father.' And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many.'" Let's start in on verse 17. You may have a heading in your Bible that says something like, "Jesus foretells his death a third time." This is the third time here in the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus has predicted that he is going to go to Jerusalem and he's going to die. And there's a lot of detail in this third and final time that he makes this prediction. This is, in fact, right on the cusp of this unfolding, because in chapter 21 we have the triumphal entry, and really the rest of the book of Matthew unfolds there in Jerusalem. And there is much detail here in this section. Notice that Jesus takes the 12 disciples aside and he speaks to them privately. And he's not speaking in veiled language. This isn't a metaphor. This is not figurative language. He's very direct with them. And he makes a very detailed statement of what is going to happen to him. You could break it into 9 different elements of things that are going to happen to them. Let's just read what those are again. Somebody read for us 18 and 19, what Jesus says.
"See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day."
All right, so 9 statements. That's how I broke it down. So he's going to Jerusalem. He's going to be the Son of Man, which we know is him, will be delivered over to the chief priests, that's number 2, and the scribes, breaking that up because that's their distinct groups. They will condemn him to death, number 4. Number 5, they will deliver him over to the Gentiles, so not just these Jewish leaders, but also the Gentiles. They will mock him, 6. They will flog him, number 7. They will crucify him, and then he will be raised, and then raised on the third day. Actually, that may actually be 10. I may have miscounted. So how many of those are within Jesus' control and the fact that he can make it happen?
He can go to Jerusalem.
One of them, yeah, exactly. That's the only one. He can go up to Jerusalem and he can make that part of it happen. But the other ones of them are not within Jesus' control, right? From a human, earthly perspective, the other things are things that are going to happen to him. And these are things that are... that could be falsified, meaning they are things that could be proven not to have happened to him. These are concrete things, right? This is not vague. This is, I am going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered over into these specific people's hands. They are going to do this, that, and the other to me, and then I will be raised on the third day. So it's amazing, and from a standpoint of Jesus' confidence, from a standpoint of his predicting these things, even as a prophet, to do this. So let me ask this. How does Jesus know that this is going to happen? How does Jesus know what's going to happen concerning himself?
Well, you bet Isaiah 53. So I was going to suggest before that, maybe he prayed about it and got an impression from his father.
Okay. So he praying about it, and there's some revelation that's coming to him from his father. That's possible. Do you think that's probable? Do you think that's what happened?
I think he studied.
It'd be more obvious if you read Isaiah 53. Yeah.
I think he studied the what we now call the Old Testament intently.
Yeah.
And he's even the phrase Son of Man is a direct allusion back to the Old Testament.
Right.
There's even evidence here that he's getting this from,
yeah,
from the Old Testament.
Right. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. He knows the scriptures. He knows the law and the prophets and the writings. He knows what is in the Old Testament. And he understands it. Remember when he was 12 years old, he's in the temple, he has advanced understanding even at a young age about these things and what's in the scriptures. So it's a little bit of a, it's not necessarily clear here in the scriptures in these verses, but we know that Jesus was consistently going out to spend time with his father alone, but he was also competent in the scriptures. He knew the scriptures and he studied them. He was masterful with them when he would interact with the Jewish leaders concerning the matters of the law. So it seems like what's going on here is that God has revealed to Jesus through the Old Testament scriptures what's going to happen to the Messiah, and he knows that that is himself. So let's talk about, we mentioned Isaiah 53, where are some other places in the Old Testament where Jesus could have known these things? Even some of these specific details.
There's that passage in Isaiah where, in Hosea, where the people are saying they're sort of fickle and they're always thinking they can presume on the Lord's favor. And so they say, come, let's return to the Lord, and on the third day he will revive us.
Okay.
I guess you might think that, that if the Messiah was to be sort of Israel's representative, in some sense.
He refers to his time in the tomb as a sign of Jonah.
Okay. And Jonah was in the
belly of the fish for
3 days and three nights. Jesus even makes that statement about himself earlier in the Gospels, that no sign will be given to this wicked generation except for the sign of Jonah. Right.
It's possible he heard Jonah and thought, well, that's what's going to happen to me.
Yeah.
At the very least, he knows by that point he's going to be down 3 days, because he learned it from Jonah or just saw the illusion himself.
Mm-hmm. So Isaiah, Jonah, Hosea.
Psalm that closely parallels some of the gospel accounts of the crucifixion. Psalm 22.
Yeah, that's I think that's a big one.
I can't remember all the details, but I think mocking is very specific in that one.
Right. Yep. Being surrounded, being mocked. They pierce my hands and feet. That's in Psalm 22.
Daniel chapter 9 has that really perplexing chapter about 77s. But one thing that's not so perplexing is it talks about how when Jerusalem is rebuilt, the anointed one will be cut off. It seems like it's saying the Messiah will die in Jerusalem.
Okay, so there's the going to Jerusalem and these things happening in Jerusalem.
Where was that? Daniel 9:26.
So, kind of on a different note, I was remembering that one of the accounts of the Transfiguration says that Moses and Elijah talked to Jesus about his departure, which isn't in Matthew, but Luke says, and behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem.
Okay.
So it's unclear what they actually said, but they were talking about his, what was going to happen in Jerusalem.
Right. And I wonder if Moses and Elijah would have had an inside track of what, I probably would think not, actually, but they don't necessarily know more than these things aren't necessarily, there'd be a lot of speculation there.
Yeah, but it's just interesting that they were discussing this subject, and maybe Jesus was more clear on the details after talking with them.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see anything about chief priests and scribes in the Old Testament?
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that, actually. Maybe there might be some things about the shepherds of Israel or the leaders of Israel, and I'm not sure how specific that gets about them mistreating. Yeah, but there might be something there. I'm not sure on all of these elements, like if I can point to an exact one. I think we've covered a lot of the territory that I would have said about Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, I think also Psalm 16 about you will not abandon my soul to decay, that Jesus expected to be resurrected. Jonah, that's very helpful. So this is all, it's kind of an open question, and I think we should think about it. The point I want to make is that it wasn't like Jesus just, that God just told him, or that Jesus had this crystal ball or something like that, or because he's divine, he just automatically knows everything about the future, and he's foreseen it all that way. He sees it primarily through the text, and God has been revealing it to him through the scriptures. It seems like that's the way that this works out when we put together Jesus' time that he spends alone with the Father, plus his understanding and mastery of the scriptures, and the fact that the Old Testament scriptures, they point to these things, and they are prophesied there.
One place where you might get a clue, and I think there might be more places in this, but where Jesus explicitly cites an Old Testament text and says, it's you, to the chief priests and scribes. So when he cites Isaiah 29, and he says, you love me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me. So there might be some difficulty in knowing exactly why Jesus cites that text, but that would be a good place to start, probably.
Yeah. There are surely more mysteries in these types of things to unravel than what we currently know and understand.
And it also seems like throughout all the Gospels that Jesus has the understanding that of who he is.
Yeah.
That he's the Christ, he is the Messiah. I mean, and if anything, the special events that took place during his baptism would probably definitely hit even more to that.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the voice of God declaring there. I think it was, this is my son.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Yep. Yeah, there's definitely, seems like by this time, a solid understanding by Jesus that he is the Messiah. So he can go to Jerusalem with confidence and say that these things are going to happen about me. And it's not arrogance. It's not presumption. It's what is true. Let's look at the next section now with that as a backdrop. I think these things are put together on purpose. We'll see why. The mother of the sons of Zebedee. So who are the sons of Zebedee? James and John. The sons of Zebedee are called the sons of thunder. And so the mother actually comes up. We haven't seen her before in the Gospels, but she comes up with James and John and kneels before Jesus, and she makes a request. The woman asks Jesus that these two sons of hers can sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom. So Jesus says, what do you want? She says, I'd like this. First of all, what does this represent, to sit at your right and your left? What's behind that request? What is she asking for?
To co-rule, co-reign, to be
right up there.
These are honorable positions in the kingdom, or the administration that she expects Jesus to install. These are the honored positions.
Yeah. Positions of honor in administration. So there's probably some idea that not only is it prestigious, but it's also a position of authority. It's a position of preeminence, prominence, getting to rule along with Jesus. It's like being vice presidents. Like Jesus is the president and they're vice presidents, or they're Jesus's cabinet ministers. They get to be in charge and be in the places of honor. So Jesus' answer is, of course, interesting. He says, you do not know, verse 22, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? And they said to him, we are able. We are able. Amazing answer, right? It's just amazing that they would answer that. First of all, what sphere, Christopher alluded to this, but what sphere do you think that James and John and their mother are thinking in with this question? They're thinking of the kingdom, but they probably view the kingdom as primarily an earthly reality that's going to come when the Messiah arrives and the Messiah conquers and the Messiah puts his enemies under his feet, as they're expecting to happen in the here and now. Jesus, though, is going to indicate that he's talking about something else. So Jesus doesn't respond with a yes or a no. His response indicates that those positions are available, that someone will be sitting there, because he says in the next verse that sitting at my right hand and my left hand is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. So those positions are being prepared by God for someone. So the response is not saying that these positions are available, but it's saying you do not understand the terms on which those positions are to be gained. You do not understand how someone is going to ascend to those positions. Jesus follows it up with a question. He says, are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? We'll talk for a moment about what the cup is, but note that they say yes, and Jesus says, well, actually, you will. He says, you will do that in verse 23. So again, he's not even saying, how dare you, or no, you can't. He says, you will. You will do this. So what is the cup that Jesus will drink?
I mean, I immediately think of the cup of wrath.
The cup of wrath.
Common cup metaphor.
Okay. That is true. That is true. So there are some verses in the Old Testament that talk about sinners or the wicked drinking from the cup of God's wrath. And the idea there is that they drink this cup of strongly mixed wine that represents God's wrath, and they stagger. It's like it's overpowering, and they stagger, and it's a punishment. So that is something that's in the background that shows up in, well, I'll just read one representative text, Isaiah 51. Wake yourself, stand up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. So let's hold that for a moment. That is in the background. What other thoughts do you have about the cup that Jesus will drink?
Kind of think about like all the suffering he went through, you know, with, you know, being handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and then and then over to the Gentiles, and just that mocking, that flogging, that being crucified.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do know that many of the apostles were martyred.
Right. Right. The cup of suffering, the cup of the path of suffering that God has called him to, maybe would be a way to say that.
Yeah.
And we do see that Jesus does use this cup metaphor again. He uses it, for instance, in Matthew 26. He will say, when he's praying in Gethsemane, he's praying to the Father, and he says, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And it's even more clear in some of the other Gospels in Luke that is rendered, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Or in John 18, Jesus says to Peter, when they come to arrest Jesus, he says to Peter, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?
Is that, because I think of that cup as being him, the wrath of God because of the burden of sin that Jesus takes on our behalf, which is only his to drink. So that the way I think about that cup metaphor is that Jesus is the only one who drinks it across all time. So if John and James are to drink this cup, the cup he's talking about here, it's not quite the same as that one, though it may be talking about suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are very important factors as we try to interpret this. We definitely have this metaphor of a cup of wrath in the background in the Old Testament. However, in the immediate context, we have Jesus saying that they will drink the cup.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the cup were to be the cup of the cup of God's wrath that Jesus took for sinners, that would not seem to fit because of what Jesus says about James and John. They are obviously not taking the cup of God's wrath towards sin upon themselves. They're not involved in atoning for sin. So I tend to interpret this, I would say that it is the cup of the path of suffering that Jesus is called to, that the disciples are called to follow in as well. That they are both, Jesus is called to take, to drink this cup, which means to walk this path of suffering, to use another metaphor. And the disciples are also called to walk a path of suffering. Might there be some connection with Jesus drinking the cup of wrath? Perhaps that's in the background, but I don't want to say that very strongly because I don't see another place in the scriptures, at least I haven't seen one, that clearly says that Jesus drinks the cup of God's wrath for sin. We know that Jesus bears the wrath of God. He bears the sin of man. But I would just want to be a little careful there.
You're seeing, though, in each of those instances, the metaphor of drinking a cup of something you don't want to drink.
Yes.
So that's a linguistic connection all there throughout all that. It's not saying in the cup metaphor that the thing you don't want to drink is necessarily the same in each instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a thing that's hard to swallow.
Yeah, I guess you could say that maybe the Roman occupation, sort of the Roman dominance of Israel, and the way that Herod the Great and sort of worked for Rome might be part of the judgment of God on Israel or something. And so, in some sense, if Jesus and the disciples sort of experience persecution because of that, or death because of that. I don't know. Maybe you could see it loosely as part of the wrath of God in a general sense.
Yeah, I could follow that line of interpretation. It's interesting. Right.
Yeah, we would generally rule out the cup of the Passover. There were, I think, more than one cup in the Passover ceremony. I think we would all agree that that's probably not what he's talking about here.
Right, I don't think he's talking about the cup at the Passover.
Hmm.
No, because I wouldn't see the significance of saying, can you drink this cup that I'm going to drink? Meaning, can you be at the last Passover with me?
Part of that is I don't know the meaning of those cups. Like, I think that there were more than one, and there was one that was not, generally not drunk, like, as a sign of it was for someone in the future to drink.
I've heard those things, but I always struggle with feeling like there's much significance to be had there because the scriptures don't bring that out.
Yeah, one of the gospel accounts has him presenting two cups to the disciples during that meal, but that's about the only thing. Like, he doesn't describe the significance of the difference between the cups.
Right.
Other than, like, he talks about the cup that they're drinking being the new covenant in his blood. Obviously, that is significant.
Yes.
But there's not, we don't see it super clearly that that's the last cup or the one that people would never have drunk before that.
Yeah.
Like, that's not.
Right. It's not declared. a major element that the text is trying to teach us something through. So what is the cup? I would say it's the cup of suffering that Jesus is called to walk, that the disciples, because they're his disciples, are also called to walk. And that's what Jesus says in verse 23. You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. So James and John, they also will have a path of suffering to walk. They are going to suffer for the kingdom, and we see that. How do we see that in the rest of the New Testament? What suffering do you know that these sons of Zebedee experience?
Prison, flogging, being cast out of the temple.
Banishment.
Yep, banishment. So John is exiled to Patmos. We don't have this from the scriptures, but from other early Christian history that John was the lone disciple of the 11 remaining that was not martyred. And James, actually, is the first disciple that is martyred, and that's actually in Acts chapter 8. He was put to death in Jerusalem by the sword. Chapter 12, thank you.
About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword.
So Herod kills, kills James there. Thank you for that reference. So this is fulfilled, and it is, in fact, what happens. James is killed. John is exiled to Patmos. We see that at the beginning of Revelation. And yet, even with this, James and John are not necessarily in the highest places of honor. Didn't rule it out from what Jesus answered. So it could be them. Could be one of the 12, but it could be somebody else. Could be somebody that we have never heard of or will never hear of, right? Because why do we say that? Why is that possible? Because prominence, in the way that the world counts prominence, is not equal to kingdom prominence. Worldly greatness, which often goes along with honor or being heard of in the world, is not the same thing as kingdom greatness and kingdom honor. And that's what Jesus is teaching the disciples after the situation settles down and James and John's mother leaves the scene. One thing before we leave that, notice that it says, it is for those for whom it has been prepared. It is for those for whom it has been prepared. What does that tell us about the nature of suffering, the nature of how we fulfill a calling of suffering?
God has ordained all martyrs just as he ordained Christ's death.
Yeah. It's something that God has prepared. So think about it. Think about it. This person hasn't even been born yet. And they are going to be the person for whom it is prepared to sit at his right or his left. And this person, this path, is already prepared for them. It's already foreordained. As Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 2, that God has prepared good works in advance for us to walk into. That this place of honor is prepared for a person who God has a plan that person will walk. So if you have a path of suffering to walk, as you do as a disciple, if you have things to sacrifice, those are things that have been prepared.
I don't know if you saw anything. My Bible has a reference to chapter 25, verse starting with 33, and he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. And the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you.
Interesting. I did not look at that connection. It seems like the connection is obviously the right and the left, and if that was a meaningful connection, it might indicate that someone is thinking that those on the right are those who are saved and those who are on the left are those who are damned.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not...
This is just the permission of God, like the inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.
It could be. Yeah, again, I didn't look at the reference, but it seems like in the context of Matthew 20 here, he's talking about both right and left are good.
Oh,
they're positions of honor. Obviously that's what James and John's mother wanted. She wanted...
But she got in a little trouble with James.
She had a bad day.
Jacob and Esau situation there.
I mean, I guess that's another question. Is it right for us to assume that she is right in thinking that both the left and right side of Christ is good?
Well, in her mind, it's good, and I think Jesus answers her according to that understanding.
Well, I mean, just again, going back to that reference in chapter 25, there is a good and a bad side, the right side being,
yeah.
And then the left side, the damned. So.
Yeah, which
the sheep are sitting there.
Yeah, the sheep are sitting on one side, and...
That's mixing metaphors.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just
think it's a similar metaphor with a different meaning.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And the specific in text thing to key in on in chapter 25 is he says enter into this kingdom. And so in chapter 25, those on the right are entering into the kingdom. The
right.
Question is, where are they within once they're in the kingdom?
Gotcha.
Here in chapter 20.
Right.
I have two wonderful sons, Jesus,
yeah.
And I know they're in your inner circle already, and they're in the kingdom, so once you get it going, so
right.
There's a difference,
yep,
there.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
again,
right.
At this time, Judas is there too, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, that's
yeah.
That's not what's in Mrs. Zebedee's mind.
Gotcha.
Thunder Mom. Yeah.
Thunder Mom? Oh, she was Thunder, I thought.
Yeah. No, I... it does seem a little funny here, how they respond. The other ten hear about it, and they are mad. Why are they mad?
They want to be there
too. Exactly, right? This reminds me of like how I would have felt in high school basketball if one of the other players on my team, if his mom went to the coach and said, you know, Johnny should be in the starting five. I'd be like, you know, the rest of the team, we would be, you know, because how can you turn down somebody's mom, right? That might even be what's going on, is it's harder to return, you know, it's harder to turn down an older woman who's asking. So they're mad. It's like, you pulled a fast one on us, James and John. You should not have done that. And obviously the reason is because they want those spots. They're not angry because they feel like, because they understood it in the same terms that Jesus did, and they're angry because they got beat to the punch. So Jesus calls them to him and says, verse 25, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them." And then he's going to contrast that in 26 with how it should be in the kingdom. So he's contrasting the Gentiles. Basically, by this he means the world, those who are not of Israel, those who do not fear God. This is how they act. Let's just pause for a moment. Who are some rulers of the Gentiles? What kind of people are we talking about here?
Emperors.
Caesar Augustus.
Governors, like Pilate.
Pilate, yeah.
I mean, even probably Herod, who's put in place by...
Herod, yeah. Herod's a Jew in a way, but he's, you know, he's not acting according to the fear of God. He would be like one who acts this way.
Isn't he an Edomite? He's not even a real Jew.
Right. He kind of, there's some pretense. I don't remember it, but yeah. The pharaohs of Egypt. Just other leaders, rulers, tyrants of antiquity would be the kinds of people that Jesus has in mind here.
Not any leader nowadays.
Right. Yeah. It's not fundamentally different. It would be really any human who operates according to the principles of the world and self-interest and who is out for themselves, who has any sort of power or advantage over others. So how do they act? How do these kinds of people act? Well, the text says that they lord it over them and they exercise authority. Those are the two phrases used, lord it over them and exercise authority. So the interesting, because the first one we don't use very much, and the second one we don't always view as bad. So what does it mean to lord it over someone?
Oppression, maybe.
To oppress.
To flaunt your authority or rulership.
Yeah. To overcome, to subdue, to gain dominion over.
I've seen that word. Oh, in Septuagint, I saw that word.
Yeah, it's, the word Lord is literally in there. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. You know, I saw it. Lord said to my Lord, sit at our hands, but if you put rule in the midst of your enemies. Rule is categorically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's this word here.
Yeah, it's
lord it over them.
Lord it over is kind of like a literal translation of that word, and it means to rule, to subdue, to gain dominion over. They take control. They enact might makes right, take what you can get, survival of the strongest. These types of mantras. And they exercise authority. So they rule over, and they domineer. I'll just pause for a moment and say that authority is not a bad thing. That God has given authority even predates the fall. There's an authority structure in the garden, God over man over woman. Authority is not a bad thing. Authority can be abused. You see that all the time. But authority can be exercised in right and godly ways. And even Christians in the New Covenant are commanded there is a right authority in different spheres. So we know that authority is not a bad thing. But in this context, it is a bad thing, because it's what these rulers are doing when they lord it over. They don't exercise godly authority. They domineer. They are seeking to subdue into it's ruling not for the benefit of those who are being ruled, but for the benefit of the ruler.
Mm-hmm. That's what Psalm 110 is talking about there.
Explain that
more. Rule and miss his enemies.
Hmm.
And that's like, if the rod of iron, these are his enemies, and he's just beating them down. It's not for their good, though.
Right. And it's in judgment.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
And it talks about the corpses, you know.
But that's not for the enemy's good. That's just
not good for the enemy.
Yeah.
Either.
Right.
So that's that lording over his death.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Another way I would summarize this idea, it's that those who have power, strength, authority, those who have the great ones, those who have some advantage over others, they're using it, but not for the good of those of others, but for the good of themselves. They're using it for their own interest and not for the interest of others. And the reason I say that is comes from the lorded over them and exercise authority, but it also comes from the contrast with how people in the kingdom are to act in verse 26. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So the principle is stated in 26 and 27, and then the prime example is given in 28. So the principle is that those who seek greatness should seek to serve. Those who want to sit at the right and the left, they should seek to take the low positions now. It's similar to what Jesus said back in chapter 19, that humility is the way to greatness in the kingdom. Going down is the way to go up in the kingdom. It's the exact opposite of the world. And he uses both of the words that we are somewhat familiar with for servant. He uses the word servant and the word slave here. So kingdom people have to take on the nature of a servant. They have to, as Jesus said of Jesus in Philippians 2, they take the form of a servant. They voluntarily put themselves in a position to serve, and they seek the interest and the good of others. They don't seek their own good, their own interest like the rulers of the Gentiles, but they seek the good and the interest of others. That's what Jesus did. Verse 28, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So as with every other virtue or trait that we should cultivate in the Christian life, Jesus is the supreme example of this. He came not to be served, but to serve. Jesus, as the Son of God, as the creator of the world, the one for whom, through whom, and to whom all things exist, he did not come into the world to be served. He did not come into the world to be to receive things from men. He came in to lay his life down as a ransom for others. And is he exalted? Yes, he's exalted. He receives everything. He inherits the kingdom. But that's not what he came to do. Or it's not what he came to do directly, as stated here in this context. He did not come to serve, to be served, but to serve. This also illustrates that Jesus is seeing a further connection with himself and the Messiah that's prophesied in the Old Testament. Just note this in passing, that major metaphor in Isaiah especially is that of the suffering servant. The servant who is God's servant, who is Israel, but is specifically Israel's anointed one, and is a servant who suffers. Here we see evidence in what Jesus says that he is seeing himself as that figure. He is the one who came to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, to suffer. Right. Well, let's try to summarize this and then talk for a few minutes about how to apply this in our lives. First of all, we see that Jesus is the greatest servant. He is the greatest servant in the kingdom. He's the greatest in the kingdom, and he's the greatest servant in the kingdom. We also see that those who would follow Jesus must become servants. We've already seen that those who follow Jesus have to actually follow Jesus in taking up their cross and being a disciple. But here we see also that they have to serve and have this mindset that I exist to serve others and to do good to others. We also see that service will involve suffering, that Jesus is here going to suffer, and he is. So when we see Jesus say, serve like I serve, we know that that involves suffering. It's not just an easy kind of service, but it's a service that is actually going to cost us something. James and John had to drink the cup. Right? And even though our cup to drink or our cross to bear, we use those different analogies, may be different, we know it will actually cost us something. It's not going to be a kind of serving that's going to be easy. And then to put this together, I think this is helpful. We see here that Jesus was the one who blazed the trail of service. We also see that God the Father prepares the way. And we also know from elsewhere in the scriptures that Jesus accompanies and gives fellowship to those who follow that path. Paul writes in Philippians that he wants to experience the fellowship of suffering with Jesus. And that's a real thing, that as we enter into suffering and serving for Jesus, we experience a supernatural fellowship because we are walking the road that he has walked. Let me pause before we talk about applications. Is there anything else you want to mention or bring out from the text? Okay. So a few things as we seek to apply this to our lives. We should worship Jesus for his life of service. We should read verses like, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, and we should worship Christ for that. That should be a beautiful thing that stirs our soul. Stirs our soul because he's done that for us, that we are someone for whom he laid down his life as a ransom. Stirred because of the beauty of it, how counter it was to everything in the world that we see around us. We've seen so many leaders and rulers of the Gentiles who exercise authority in this way, and here is the Son of God, who has every right to receive all glory and honor and authority, and he doesn't do that. And he lays down his life. So we should worship Jesus, and it's not just a functional thing that we just imitate him, but this should really stir our hearts and we should worship him. Second, we should imitate him. So we imitate Jesus by serving others. We should be slaves of others. We should be servants of others. We should not, in this life, seek to be great, seek to be lording it over people, to exercise authority. That should not be our MO and what we are seeking. But no, we should be seeking to serve others. So as we think about this, you okay? You go see Mom? Amber is my wife. wife out there? Okay. Can you go to mom? Excuse me. I need you to go to mama. She's in the front room. So how do we think about this? Well, when you're a servant, you do what others don't want to do, right? So this might be a helpful question to you. What are things that you can do that others don't want to do, that are good, that actually accomplish blessing, that bring blessing to other people? Or what are things that others cannot do? What are things that only you can do because of what, how you are positioned, or because of what God has called you to? So do what others cannot do, and do what others won't do. There are things that are hard, and others won't do them because they're hard. And those are might be the kinds of things that God would have you do, and how he would have you serve others. We also have to remember that we should serve others according to a kingdom definition of what good is. This is what it means to love other people, right? To love other people is to not necessarily do what they want, but to do what is for their good. Do what brings blessing into their lives. So, as we think about serving people, we may be serving people in ways that they don't want, right? That's what a missionary does, right? Someone goes, crosses a culture, goes into a dark place. They are serving those people, even though those people don't want it, right? They don't know what they want. They don't know what's good. So we have to remember that serving operates in a kingdom framework of what is good and what is right. I think this is something to really think about. There are so many competing formulas for how you should decide what to do in life, like how you should decide what to give your time to. And many of us here are, all of us by some measure, are on the beginning part of our lives. There, you know, according to the way things usually go, we don't know. There's a lot of years ahead of us. How do we think about what we give ourselves to? How do we think about what we do with our lives? Well, we should do things with our lives in both the big things, like vocation, but also the small things in ways that serve others, in ways that bring blessing. So we don't think about what's going to make me the most money. We don't think about what's going to make me the most comfortable, what's going to be the easiest thing to do. We think about what can I do that will, like John Wesley said, do the most good. The most good, according to a kingdom definition of what is good. That's really helpful for me. I hope it's helpful for you, because we live in a time when really there's so many endless possibilities for what we could give ourselves to. But how do we need to think about giving ourselves to the things that are going to be for the most good. So maximize your ability to do good. Maximize your ability to serve others. And making a lot of money, or having something that you're very passionate about, or something that makes you comfortable, that may happen, but maximize serving here. Realize also that your service may be very obscure and unseen, right? We talked about this earlier, that those who sit at Jesus' right or left may be people we've never heard of. And obviously the nature of a servant is that you're not getting glory. You're not out front. So if you're following this path of service, it's not going to equate to earthly greatness. It's not going to equate to a worldly honor. So be ready for that. Be prepared for that. But also know that. And actually, that should be something to glory in. I've heard from people who have a lot of worldly honor who are Christians, they don't really like it. They don't want that. It's a snare. It can be a trap. Thinking about the life of John and Charles Wesley. John and Charles Wesley's mother, Susanna, she was a godly woman. She does not have quite the high profile that John and Charles does. She had 19 children. She had 19 children. Her mother had 25 children.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I'm not putting that forward as an ideal or anything like that. But think about it. And actually, Charles Wesley was 18 of 19. Think if she said after 15 children, I don't want to be a servant anymore, you know, or which, yeah, exactly. And Susanna Wesley, their mother, she was 25 at 25. It's interesting to think about from a lot of perspectives. But the point here is that you probably haven't heard of Susanna Wesley. And she did a lot of serving if she was a mother of 19. She did a lot of serving. A lot of it was unseen, repetitive, hard, not very glorious. And that's what God had called her to, and it's not going to be what God has called everyone to, or most of us to. But we have things to do, and you know, she might get a higher place, or you know, in God's estimation, we don't know how that compares to John and Charles, right? And it again, the point isn't comparing. The point is that the prominence in the world's eyes doesn't really matter. It's serving in God's eyes. So rejoice in the service that God gives you, that he calls you to, even, and know that he is pleased with unseen, hard, repetitive, suffering work. He sees everything, and he is pleased. All right, let's pray together. Father, thank you for this, just this teaching that from Jesus that turns our world upside down, that is so different than the way that we, just that we in our flesh, that we in our sinful humanity want to act, and so different than what we see in the world. Lord, give us the grace to apply this, to think about it, and to follow it faithfully throughout our lives. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. All right, let's take a break.